This is Great Minds, a wine-centric podcast for the brainy enophiles out there. I'm Julie Glenn.
And I'm Gina Birch. And today we're talking about where people get their wine news. Now, both Julie and I have dabbled in wine journalism while living on other gigs because we know it doesn't pay that much. But it does make people wonder, you know, who is paying for wine journalism anymore? And among the unpaid or underpaid, like we both have been, in the past.
Yeah. Yep. For sure.
Who's making sure they're reporting on wine ethically? I mean, that's a big question.
It is. And one of the preeminent wine journalists of our time was in Naples recently, and I was able to sit down and talk with him at an event at Natural Wines of Naples. Gina, have you heard of John Bonnet? You've heard of him, right?
Yeah. We're not talking about John Bonnet Ramsey.
That's
the first thing that came to mind. But
yeah.
John Bonnet, all joking aside, I know he wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle for, gosh, about a decade. He's writing for Punch and I think a few other places right now as well.
Yeah, and he also writes books, and he was doing a book signing the day that I saw him for the book called The New Wine Rules. But I really wanted to ask him, because it's really been bugging me for a while, where does he see wine journalism going? So I asked.
I am puzzled as to where it's going right now. The question that's out there isn't just, is there wine journalism? Because, yes, you know, between Twitter, between Instagram, everyone who has ever tasted a wine and has an opinion on it, you know, when there was the brief blip for Delectable and Vivino in terms of crowdsourcing, there's no shortage of wine information out there, but the actual sustainable part of wine journalism, where there are places that will publish you professionally and pay you a living wage, that has grown somewhat endangered. And there's a handful of newspapers that are kind of the ones that were supporting it. Most never really supported it enough for someone to do it full time. There's a handful of magazines, but if you look at the demographics, I don't know that they're necessarily bringing in the new readership that you need when most of their boomered readers are getting to a point where they're not drinking as much wine and they're definitely not buying as much wine. And when your business model is based on getting wine companies to pay you for advertising, that's not ideal.
He makes a good point there. You got, and then it's kind of, there's like the polarization. You got the traditional wine media, and then you have the social media. What do you think about social media wine writers? People that just kind of, you know, they build up a reputation of criticizing or liking wines. They almost never criticize.
No, and you know, this is kind of a sore spot, but one of those sticky spots with me, because I went to school for journalism, and when you are a journalist, it doesn't mean that you write any better than maybe some of these lay people, but you understand the art, you understand why you do things a certain way, you know the ethics, which is a big deal. You know, you have to take all of these classes because when you're putting something out there for general consumption, you have a responsibility, and a lot of the people who are doing the social media stuff don't have that same responsibility or ethics behind it. But anybody can do it now. It's wide open. The field's wide open. If you have an opinion, you put it out there. If you consider yourself an expert, then all of a sudden its perception becomes reality. So everyone else is always going to say, oh, that person's an expert, whether they are or not.
And, you know, as a wine writer, we get bottles sent to us. I mean, I don't write about wine anymore in the paper, but I would always get these bottles sent to us. And then there's the question, is it ethical to write about that wine because you just got free stuff from them?
You know, that's another difficult one. And I know there are some magazines and newspapers that forbid their journalists from accepting those things because of that. Because no matter how unbiased you are as a person, you still, if this person is so sweet and they keep sending you wines from this winery over and over, eventually it's going to wear you down and you're going to write about it. Doesn't mean that they bought you off. It might be that, you know, I really did like that wine. I didn't like the other three you sent, so I didn't write about those. But when the one comes along that's good, yeah, I'm going to include it.
And then there's the question about writing negative things about a wine. I mean, you know, just because I don't like it doesn't mean you don't like it. But then there's the job of the critic who has a trained palate who can identify flaws in a wine.
And that's something that I struggle with as a writer, too. It's I want to tell people what to drink. I'm not telling them what to stay away from, because if I say, and I'm just going to throw this out, you know, if I don't like personally Yellowtail, but if somebody else loves it and that's all they drink and they buy it by the magnums, and I say, well,
this is the only economical way to go with
that
stuff.
Exactly.
And that you're in a quantity versus quality situation there.
Right. But if somebody just loves it, then who am I to say that's not good wine?
Yeah.
It's not good for my palate. Doesn't mean it's not going to be good for yours. But what you were going back to talking about is how it's produced and the integrity behind the grape and is it varietally correct. Those things I think we can be critical of. But for me just to say, that's kind of you know, yucky wine or not good wine or
how many additives are in it, things like that, different flaws that happen. And when they have that volume of production, is just kind of difficult to keep up with the quality.
It's hard. I mean, you're mass producing whatever product you mass produce in life. It's once you get so big, you have trouble most of the time, or a lot of people, at least at some point along the process, had trouble maintaining a quality.
Yeah, it's tough. And then, and we've talked about it a second ago, but we're talking about the social media stuff, and it's hard. Who do you trust, you know? And then even when it's really good wine critics, there are certain wine critics that are just beloved and followed religiously. I'm not going to mention names here, but it's one that I totally don't like any of the wines that he likes.
Mm-hmm. Your palate's different.
And he'll recognize quality in things that I'm tasting it going, this tastes like about 40 other wines that I've tried.
Right.
And I'm talking about big, huge, fat Napa cabs that had that huge fruit profile, high alcohol content. It's just hard to differentiate them after a while.
No, you're right. And then you go to a tasting and you taste them all side by side. That's the only way. Sometimes you can, okay, I'm getting a little something different in here. But, you know, you throw them all together blind and they're very similar.
And then there's the other fly in the ointment that is the sponsored content.
Ah, mm-hmm.
You know, that's a tough one to identify as well. So.
Well, in the magazines, they all, you know, they have to put on the top, you know, advertorial or paid advertising. But some of that content is actually, it's well written and it's good. And then you start reading it and you forget, oh, this is not objective. This somebody is paid to write this and tell me how great this is.
I know that there's one magazine that doesn't even indicate that. They just with it. Yeah. Mm. It's kind of hard to tell which one's which.
Right.
You know? So looking over the entire wine landscape, John Bonnet sees the big guys, Wine Enthusiast and Spectator, and then all of the dedicated wine magazines versus the fragmented, unchecked hive mentality wine critic. And he had this to say.
I think the wine industry, frankly, has to think pretty seriously about what it can and will do to support people who want to do this professionally and who, frankly, aren't always going to say nice things about them. Because there's become a direct feedback loop between people who are kind of citizen journalists, the term I'll use, and who write between journalism and kind of fan appreciation and sometimes self-publish it, sometimes it's blogs, wherever it is. But that's where so much of the attention of the industry is going, because people like people who don't criticize them and who are open and want to basically say nice things. And I get that. Everyone wants good press. But at the same time, if you don't support a sustainable media for whatever industry, then I think in the end, it falls apart because you never communicate it more broadly. And like I said, I mean, there's basically a handful of general interest publications left that take an interest. And even the food magazines have basically stopped paying interest to wine. So who's going to transmit it out there? Is it really just all going to come from Instagram? Is that where the new Robert Parker is going to emerge? Someone with, you know, who posts pretty bottle photos? That may frankly be what happens, but I'd like to think that there still is a role for people who come at it with a serious mind for journalism and who come at it with a legitimate critical eye and frankly who have a good working knowledge of ethics.
And like you said, you know, the working knowledge of ethics. And, you know, when you're kind of just blogging or posting stuff on social media and you're just, you know, here's a pretty picture of an awesome bottle that I had here or there, you're not really beholden to journalistic ethics.
No, not at all. That's part of the beauty of social media, you know, and the double-edged sword, I should say, of social media. And, you know, he made the point that we were talking about earlier about writing something negative. When I think about it, my own writing, I'm trying to think, well, when was the last time I said, well, this wine fell flat or this wine was too much over-extracted? And I can't honestly think of a time lately where I've done that. You know, I'm writing about the things that I really liked and I'm not saying, however, on this tasting panel, when I tried this one, it fell flat.
I think I did a couple of times, but it was because it was pretty egregious. I mean, it was super bad or... Mm-hmm. And I've done that, but it seems like since I've gotten away from writing about it regularly, I've just really lost patience. Like now my take on wine is if I am not dazzled, I am just not having it. And I've become like maybe truly the wine snob everybody always thought I was. But, you know, I mean, just, I went to a tasting. I was out visiting family. I was in Napa. I went to a tasting room, right? Mm-hmm. It was multiple vineyards. They're smaller vineyards, which is what I'm all about, right? Mm-hmm. I love the little guys. And, of course, they're Napa, so you can't be that little if you're in Napa because, right. you know, the price for grapes there is, you know, insane. But so I go in there. I pay my $40, and I tried six wines, and I could not have been more bored.
Mm.
I was so bored. I'm like, this is just, do you have anything interesting? Do you have anything new, any different take on Cab? Do you
right.
have anything, an unusual grape? Please, someone. And it was just, oh, so. It's because, and I understand it from an economic perspective, a winemaker wants to make sure that they sell their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what's popular and that's what's going on, that's what they're going to try to make so that they can make sure they sell out. Because they have to when they have a mortgage on a, mm-hmm. you know, $1 million an acre piece of property.
Exactly. I was tasting with somebody who owned a restaurant recently, and that was one of the things that they were discussing with their staff. It's like, okay, since we're just talking about Napa Cab, I'm going to stick with that.
Well, I hate to vilify Napa Cab because it's not like it's all bad.
No, it's not. But it's like, okay, this is what people are going to expect. And then I question, well, is that good or bad? Do you want to give your people who come in your restaurant something they're going to expect, or do you want to introduce them to something new? And that's the big question. Well, do I want to find a Napa Cab that stands out, that's something new, or and if people try it and say, this isn't what I expected, I'm unhappy with it. You know, so they're walking a little tightrope when it comes to that as well.
Yeah, and that's at a restaurant too, which is even tougher because it's not, you know, buying wine that's unusual in a restaurant is never cheap.
You have to hand sell it. You know, you have to say, this is not your typical Cab. You're going to love it. Try it.
But I've been encouraged by the natural wine movement just in that people are now drinking things that taste completely different mm-hmm. from what you expect.
Right.
Where I did this interview with John Bonnet, he was at Natural Wines of Naples. His whole store is full of all these natural wines. I had a Malbec in there
mm-hmm.
From, I think it was from Oregon, and it was not your grandma's Malbec. I mean, you wouldn't
right.
put a lamb chop with this. It was so light, and it was just really totally unusual, and I just loved it because it was something different. You know what
right.
I'm saying?
I get it. So he was in town talking about his new book, and I think, if I remember correctly, that's called The New Wine Rules.
Mm-hmm.
Do we really need more rules in wine or anything in life?
Rules, edicts,
yeah.
laws. I asked him that. That's like the first question
oh, really?
I asked him. I'm like, so do we really need wine rules? I think that it's already kind of stuffy and uppity mm-hmm. enough. And he explained it to me. It was pretty cool. He's, you know, we wanted to take it beyond the usual book. Here's what he had to say about it.
The question was, could we do a wine book that actually reflected the much more freeform world of wine that exists today and give people not this sense of, you know, this is the Loire and this is why you should care, but say, this is how you navigate. This is how you behave in an adult way that will hopefully help you to find what you like and what makes you happy. In a world that frankly isn't as simple as any of the basic wine books out there have generally portrayed. And you know, the world doesn't need more lectures on Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Grigio. There are plenty, and if you really know, I think I said it in the introduction, if you need to know these things, you can Google them. So what is there beyond that? And that's really where the book came from.
I really like that, you know, because if you really want to learn something, you could Google all the
right.
time.
Mm-hmm.
What is Semillon? I would like to know. Let me ask Google.
Mm-hmm.
But then these are more of those experiential things, like how to properly maintain your glassware. Don't put it in the dishwasher for these reasons.
Right.
And all those little background things that you may not get from a Google search, but it'll help you kind of round out the experience. And I've got a number of wine books, and none of them really taught me all this stuff.
But no, you're right. I've got them too. I was just thinking about the ones I have in my desk and this is just basic good common sense kind of things. It sounds like.
Yeah, well, because we've been doing wine for so long, it's totally common sense. This is a great thing for people that don't feel super comfortable in wine or mm-hmm. would like to learn a little bit more. It kind of rounds out some of those edges instead of the specifics of Semillon again. So I want to ask you, do you have a wine rule that is hard and fast for you?
Oh gosh. When you have a bottle at the table and you have three or four, five, six, however many people enjoying that bottle, don't fill it up Oh, it just drives me crazy when someone grabs that glass and they fill it halfway like it's a buy-the-glass glass. And it's a huge glass, and I'm looking at it saying, save some for the rest of us. What are you doing? For the love of God, put
don't
the bottle
Bogart
down.
The wine. Yeah. Seriously, yeah. Or they do it to the person that you know doesn't drink that much.
Yes. They'll fill them first. I'm like, oh.
And you're looking at it crying like, I'm just going to take the glass. I'm just going to take it from them because I know it's going to get wasted, and they're not going to enjoy it.
Oh. See, I'm getting a little nervous just even thinking about it.
I'm getting annoyed. I'm annoyed on your behalf. My thing is I hate when I see in mass media or any kind of depiction in movies or something like this where they – and it's almost always a woman they have doing this – holding a glass by – the bowl instead of by the stem because they look all snugged up in their little, you know, on their couch watching
and you see their pretty diamonds.
And yeah, and they have their great nails and manicures and stuff. And they're like holding it like it's a brandy snifter and they're trying to heat it up. There's a reason for the stem, people. It's so that the warmth of your hand doesn't make your wine warmer. Please just use those stems. There's a reason for them. And then, and then Riedel comes out with the stemless glasses.
I know.
Come on.
You're not doing me and then you get the fingerprints on it, and it's so unsightly. Anyway, you know, small problems in a world that's full of other ones, but these are the ones that really get my goat to. I get it.
And we talk a lot about, you know, one of the best ways to get to know about wine is to go to tastings. What's a wine rule that you would suggest for people going to tastings that aren't familiar?
Spit. It's okay to spit in public. It's okay to spit if you don't like it. You said before, you know, you don't like, if you're not dazzled, you're going to dump it, right?
Yeah.
If it doesn't dazzle you, or if you in just dump it or spit. I think people are really afraid. Like, I can't spit in public. What if it dribbles? Like, who cares? Everybody else is too. And I'd rather spit it out and not ingest the calories or any more of the flavor that I don't like when there's a whole table full of things to try.
And if you're uncomfortable with the spit, I had to do this. This is a learning experience. I did a trade tasting one time and thousands of wines, right? So one of the first ones, I decide, okay, I really don't want to drink all this, so I'm going to go ahead and spit. So I went to spit into the actual bucket, right? Mm-hmm. And it hit the spit bucket, and something happened, and that drip kind of
splashed
right back up into my eyeball. So I walked around that terry tasting looking like half Alice Cooper the rest of the way. My eye makeup's all over. It was disgusting.
No.
So the solution to this, because I didn't spit for a while, and that didn't work out. Just ask my liver. No, but so if you carry around a spit cup with yourself, you kind of look like you're chewing tobacco or something, but you get one of those red party cups and just spit in that and carry it with you and then dump it out as you go. That's always a better solution. You can put your lips right on there. It's all yours. You're not sharing any germs.
And you can subtly spit, like you're drinking, and just let it kind of roll out.
Yeah, you can just be like, you don't have to, it's not a spittoon.
That's a good tip.
I love that. That was a learning experience, learning from experience. Don't make the mistakes I've made.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been fun talking about wine journalism. I don't know where it's going. It's getting really social, and it's getting kind of like the Wild Wild West, speaking of spittoons, but I don't know how it can be corrected or what...
I don't see a solution either, not with the way social media continues to grow and evolve and become so important in our society.
He kind of mentioned maybe a wine industry sponsored type of a publication, or I would guess probably website at this point with social, that wineries would get together. But I don't know how you do that. What kind of how's the Chianti Co-op going to get involved with the growers of Central Coast of California to oversee something like that?
Right. Because they want to promote their own interests. I mean, at the end of the day, let's be honest.
Yeah. All right. Well, we haven't solved that one just yet for today, but I want to thank you for joining us for our podcast. Great Minds is produced at WGCU Studios on FGCU campus in Fort Myers, Florida. Our producers for online media are Anna Bejarano and Tara Callaghan.
Technical production is by Richard Chinqui. Great Minds theme music is Frizzante. That's by Colin Mannon.
To get in touch, check greatminds.org. Thanks for listening.